I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, with a writer about a novel in a conversation that all felt most unusually affecting. A meeting of souls, it seemed, with the soul that made mine wiser. The writer that so many other writers are talking about is the Indian-born New Yorker Akhil Sharma. His novel is Family Life, faithful recounting in fiction of a horrific swimming pool accident that did catastrophic brain damage to his gifted older brother and smashed his family's immigrant adventure. Our conversation, like the book, is also about how writers are made, how agony becomes art, how memory wants to be nudged forward. Akhil Sharma is telling us that he chiseled 7,000 pages in draft down to barely 200 pages in hardcover. It was a project, he says, that was full of love more than sadness. It was designed to be useful to his parents and other people, and designed to move like a rocket. The conversation jumped from writing to life and back again, from Hemingway to Chekhov and Proust and the devices of storytelling and fiction, and we found we were high on one another almost before we began.
Chris, it's wonderful to meet you. You know, it's sort of thrilling to be in your house and to see the books that you read and to think, oh, you know, to be in your house and to see your books is to see how your mind is furnished, you know, and that's it's a thrilling thing.
Ooh, thank you. It's a joy to meet you, Akhil. This is my first Akhil Sharma book, and we're all kind of overwhelmed. It reminds me of those great late Tolstoy stories, Death of Ivan Illich or Master and Man. But what gripped me especially about it to distraction was a sort of heroic sadness. But I'd like you to take it also, to start, as an exercise in writing. I want to know how you did it.
You know, I began writing because I was very unhappy and I wanted to change my life. This is when I was in high school.
That's what Rilke said. You must change your life.
You must change your life. And, you know, I wanted to be admired. I wanted to be loved, right? And so I would lie all the time to say things that would bring me attention. And I used to lie about the books I had read. At one point, I decided to read a biography of Ernest Hemingway because I thought that would allow me to lie more effectively, you know, about his books. So I read this biography, and it amazed me that he had gotten to travel around the world and do this without having to be a doctor or an engineer, which is what I expected my life to end up. And so I began reading. I thought, okay, now I'll be a writer too. I don't have to be good. I just need to hit a certain threshold of competency. It was very much like that. Like, what do I need to do to get a different life? And that's sort of how I became a writer. And I immediately got attention, you know, and I think it was largely due to my subject matter, because when I began doing it, there wasn't that much Indian fiction. Though I do think that what I was writing was good, was strong. Like, there's a section in the novel, which was the first thing that I ever wrote, which is about Ajay, the protagonist, waking up to his brother's coughing and then deciding, oh, I can write a short story based on it. And then he writes a story about a man waking up to his wife's coughing.
Would you read that?
Sure. Please? And this is page 158. The first story I wrote was about my brother coughing. I woke one night to the sound of Birju coughing downstairs and then could not go back to sleep. To be woken this way and not be able to return to sleep struck me as sad enough to merit a reader's attention. Also, Hemingway had written a story about a man being woken because somebody is dying nearby and the man is forced to witness the death. I got up from my bed and turned on the light. I then returned to bed with a spiral-bound notebook and placed it against my knees. I began my story in the middle of the action the way Hemingway did. I wrote, "The coughing wakes me. My wife coughs, and then when her throat is clear, she moans. The nurse's aide moves back and forth downstairs. The hospital bed jingles." I wrote that it was a spouse coughing because that seems something a reader could identify with, while a brother would be too specific to me. I lie here listening to my wife cough, and it is hard to believe that she is dying. It was strange to write something down and for that thing to come into existence. The fact that the sentence existed made Birju's coughing somehow less awful. As I sat on my bed, I thought about how I could end my story. I held my pencil above the sheet of paper. According to the essays I had read on Hemingway, all I needed to do was attach something to the end of the story that was both unexpected and natural. I imagined Birju dying. This had to be what would eventually happen. As soon as I imagined this, I did not want him gone. I felt a surge of love for Birju. Even though he was sick and swollen, I did not want him gone. I wrote, "I lie in my bed and listen to her cough, and am glad she is coughing, because this means she is alive. Soon she will die, and I will no longer be among the lucky people whose wives are sick. Fortunate are the men whose wives cough. Fortunate are the men who cannot sleep through the night because their wives' coughing wakes them."
The story in this story is of a horrible accident in a public swimming pool where your older brother Birju strikes his head on the bottom of the stone or cement and then lingers there for 3 minutes, which effectively destroys the working of his brain. And he lives on for years after that as a totally dependent boy in a coma or boy with severe brain damage, depends on how we see it, until he died 2 years ago. There are many ways to report that news as a story. When did you enter self-consciously into telling the truth of that story and what it did to the family? When did you take up that project as a writing exercise?
So there's the facts of it. The facts of it are almost completely true. That is, my brother dived into a swimming pool, struck his head on the bottom of the pool, lay underwater for 3 minutes, was pulled out, and had suffered severe brain damage. My parents took care of him in hospitals for 2 years, and then we brought him home and took care of him ourselves for 28 years. And then he died 2 years ago. So all of that is true. I began writing this story, this novel, about, now it's about 14 years, but it took about 12 and a half years to write it. I began writing it simply because I needed something to write about, and I wrote a story and people liked the story very much, and I thought, okay, I can do this. Before I wrote it, I talked to my parents before I began working on it, and I asked my mother, and I told her that I was writing this book, and she said, "Akhil, just make sure I look good." You know, nobody in my family reads. And my father said, "Akhil, if you want to keep a secret, put it in a book." And then recently, when the galleys were ready, when the bound proofs were ready, I asked my parents if they wanted to read it. And my father said, "You know why? I was there." And my mother said that would just make her sad, and so she just didn't want to read it. I don't view fiction as me working things out. You know, this is not therapy. What I do feel with this book is that there was something I wanted to give my brother, and there was something I wanted to give my parents by capturing them, you know, capturing their difficulties. And so I wanted to represent them in the complicated way that they existed before me and during these years. For me, when I see people behaving badly, my response is not, "How can you do it?" But, "Poor fellow, you must be suffering." You know, even if you're not really aware of it, you've gotten into habits of thought that deprive you from the pleasures and love that exist in the world.
There's endless bad behavior in the home life of this family, Akhil. Endless mean verbal abuse before and after the swimming pool accident. The younger brother, Ajay, representing you, has selfish hopes to emerge as an only child if his big brother dies. His mother asks if he's praying for Birju's health. "No," he says, "he's praying for a perfect math exam." And it's not just the boy that has these sort of outlaw thoughts or shocking ideas. Akhil Sharma, would you read about the second anniversary of Birju's accident from the book?
August 5th was the second anniversary of Birju's accident. That morning, when I woke up, I lay on my side. I couldn't believe that everything had changed because of 3 minutes. One evening, not long after the anniversary, my father was in Birju's room drinking tea. I came and stood next to him. I was very unhappy. My father must have sensed this. He patted my head quickly, and in his quickness, I knew that there was both an acknowledgement of me and also a desire that I move away and not say anything. After a moment, I said, "Daddy, I'm so sad." "You're sad," my father said angrily. "I want to hang myself every day." Again, you know, we say that these are outlaw, or that's the phrase that you used. It seems to me very human.
Of course. You know,
we're overwhelmed oftentimes. And when we're overwhelmed, we don't want to honor our responsibilities. You know, we don't want to, you know, this poor man is suffering. And he realizes that not only does he have all these needs to meet in terms of his sick child, he has the needs of this other child. And he wants to push him away. And that to me is, again, so human. He says this thing out of anger and to drive the child away. But I also want, in that phrasing, to feel the humor of it. Like, I want to hang myself every day. You know, that you can't do this every day. And I want to fill the book full of life. That's sort of my goal. And so I'm always sort of changing tones. I want sentences to be... to have enough facets that you can respond in different ways.
There's something very human about Ajay's dialogues with God. I wish you'd read that one a little earlier when he asks, "Are things getting worse?"
Mm-hmm.
Page 64.
"Are things getting worse?" I asked God. November had just begun. Soon it would be Thanksgiving and then Christmas. And after this, there would be a new year. And in that new year, there would not have been a single day in which Birju had walked or talked. "What do you think?" "They seem to be. At least Birju's hospital hasn't forced him out. At least Birju isn't dead. At least Daddy's bus has never fallen off a bridge." God was silent. "I'm ashamed," I said. "About what?" "That after the accident, I was glad I might become an only child." "Everybody thinks strange thoughts," God said. "It doesn't matter if you think something. When I was walking around in the schoolyard and you asked if I would switch places with Birju, I thought, no. That too is normal. Why don't you make Birju like he was?" As soon as I asked the question, God stopped feeling real. I knew then that I was alone, lying under my blanket, my face exposed to the dark. Christ was my son. I loved Job. How long did Ram have to live in the forest? What does that have to do with me? Normally, this was the time to start discussing my glorious future. But the idea of a future where Birju was sick made fame seem pointless. I can't tell you what the connection is, but you'll be proud of yourself. I didn't say anything. God and I were silent for a while. "What are 3 minutes for you?" I asked. "Just get rid of the 3 minutes when Birju was at the bottom of the pool. Presidents die in less time than that. Planes crash in less time than that." I opened my eyes. My mother was on her side, and she had a blanket pulled up to her neck. She looked like an ordinary woman, her face sagging, her mouth open. It surprised me that you couldn't tell just by looking at her that she spent all day, every day in a hospital, that she spent all day sitting by her son who was in a hospital bed, who was once going to go to the Bronx High School of Science, but who was now so brain damaged that he could not walk or talk, could not turn over in his sleep, and had to be fed through a rubber tube that went into his side.
Even before Bridget's accident, something brutal, something hard enters his life in that race to get into the Bronx High School of Science.
You know, my brother got into the Bronx High School of Science, and so he got in right before the summer when his accident occurred. And then after the accident, my mother kept writing the high school asking if his admission could be deferred. You know, she continued to believe that he would get better. When I was writing this book, I often had the option of choosing a fictional detail versus an actual detail from my life. And I chose almost always to use something from my life. And partially because I want what happened to not vanish. You know, I want it memorialized in some way. And so that, you know, we're ordinary people. You know, what happened to my family is what can happen to anybody. But I didn't want it lost.
Mm.
I tried to bring into this novel stories, details about the community that I grew up in, because the community, the first 10, 15 years of the Indian American community forming, it's something we were not paying much attention to because we were running so hard. Mm. And I wanted to preserve that as well. I want somewhere, some repository of that.
Would you read that business about the pride of getting into his school and how it changed him?
we began being invited to people's houses for lunch, for dinner, for tea. This was so Bridju could be introduced to these people's children. Back then, because immigrants tended to be young and the Indian immigration to America had only recently begun, there were few Indians who could serve as role models. We took the subway all over Queens, the Bronx. We even went into Manhattan. We traveled almost every weekend. My mother would sit quietly in people's living room and look on proudly as Bridju talked. Once, as we were getting ready to leave our apartment to go on one of these visits, Bridju said, "Why do we have to go?" My mother answered, "They have a girl they want you to marry." She said this and laughed. "For me," my father said, "there is one thing only." He rubbed his thumb and forefinger together. "Dowry." "Leave me alone," Bridju said. My father grabbed Bridju and kissed his cheek. "Give me one egg, chicken. One egg only." "Don't say that," my mother said. "We're vegetarian. Say, give me some milk, goat. Clean, pretty goat." The pride of getting into his school changed Bridju. He sauntered. Entering a room, he appeared to be leaning back. When we spoke, he would look at me as if he were looking at someone bafflingly stupid. One time, when he looked at me this way, I blurted, "You have bad breath." I felt foolish for having pitied him when he was studying. My mother acted as if everything Bridju said was smart. One afternoon, as he sat leaning back in a chair at the kitchen table, only two of the chair's legs on the floor and one skinny arm reaching behind him and touching the wall so that he would not fall, he told our mother, "You should be a toll booth collector." "Why?" she asked from the stove where she was boiling frozen corn. "In a toll booth, people will only see your top." My mother had been talking about trying to get a government job. She didn't want to wear uniforms, though, because her hips embarrassed her. She laughed and turned to me. "Your brother is a genius." I wished I had thought of what Bridju had said. I wondered sometimes if my parents loved my brother more than they loved me. I didn't think so. They bothered him and corrected him so much more than they corrected me that I assumed they secretly preferred me to him.
Later, after the accident, that setback shatters all kinds of rules and decency and morality and self-control almost. They're denouncing each other all the time. They're at sword points forever. How did you inventory those feelings when father is drinking severely and mother has gone from this cheerful sustainer to a kind of endlessly angry person?
You know, you use the word inventory, which is sort of what part of what was going on for me in terms of the difficulty of writing this book. The motivation to preserve, to memorialize, is almost, it can harm the push that a narrative has to have. I wanted to represent these people truthfully. I wanted to represent, you know, the complications of their life. But I also did not want to capture everything, because that desire to memorialize would have destroyed the book. You know, I recognize that desire. I tried to honor it. But first and foremost, the desire was for this book to read like a rocket.
This family, they learn 1,000 things about America on the fly. Americans tip, as Indians don't. And tips work. They have an effect. Bullying happens in America, but it also can be stopped rather decisively. White people in America, they look a lot alike to Indians, and they can be quite oblivious to their power, the power simply of their standing as white people. They can be pathetic in AA meetings, unaware that they're white and they're somehow people of privilege just blowing it. The father in this family paid his boys 50 cents for every book they read. This was part of becoming an American, they decided. Mother thought that the Indian way was better, punishment for not reading a book. My impression reading this is that coming to America nowadays, it was always grueling, more for some than others, but we sentimentalized it later. It's a pretty dark picture of a process that's still going on and may go on forever.
So, you know, what counts as immigrant, we tend to think of immigrants as poor. You know, that's the category that we're reading a literature of deprivation. But they're also different, you know, but that category is vast. It would be like saying, the literature of white people. You know, so, you know, all these people are coming to America, but that they're making what is a rational choice for them. And it is immigrating has always been a very difficult thing. You know, it's almost like leaping off a cliff.
Akhil Sharma, I want you to come back to the writing of the story, because for many reasons, but you're the new standard of a kind of incisive originality, breathtaking contrasts of darkness and humor and economy. And we know that you did it by whittling down a mountain of hard stuff into this jewel. I'd love for you to take us through it and the models you tried out after Hemingway that got you there.
I wrote about 7,000 pages. And the novel is not long. It's about 200 some pages. So it feels like I wrote 35 novels. There were various problems with the book. When I read my drafts, I found them annoying. It felt sort of decadent to have a character be so engaged with memory. You know, life is so interesting. There's so many intensely pleasurable things in every single day that somebody who's sitting around remembering things, you just have to wonder, what's wrong with you, man? I mean, what exactly is it that you're sort of hugging misery to yourself like this? And that was, so for me, that didn't work. And then I began reading Chekhov. And
I'm fascinated by the Chekhov connection in you. What is it? And it's something like that story, that brutal Chekhov story in the ravine, reminds me of this in a certain way, a certain horror of family relations and cruelty, and there's a death in it, and there's a murder in it, really. But people suffering through everyday life. You've learned so much from Chekhov, but give us the short list.
I mean, I learned how to write with sort of weak transitions between paragraphs.
Yes.
That is creating a voice or a tone which would encourage the reader to move on without plot. One of the problems I was having was that I had scenes which were visceral, but we would enter into it, and then the plot was so weak that it was hard to create momentum to generate the reader's entrance into the scene and the reader's exit out of it. And so if I reverse out Chekhov, what I can do is I can create a reality which is thin. You know, because if you're only using visuals and if you don't have sound or dialogue, it's a very thin reality. And so there's very little friction as the reader moves in and out of the narrative. That thinning out, of course, makes the story feel a little bit less real. And so you have to then plump it up with introspection or interiority. So that was the reasoning that I had. And I found when I read, Nabokov said that there's an even gray tone to Chekhov, partially because there's so few visuals that things appear to be occurring in darkness. That's one thing that I learned. I learned how to have characters that are both right and wrong simultaneously. I could go on and on.
What does realism mean in that context? Or just an extremely spare, bare, essential truthfulness of the situation in complexity? That's something, again, I think you can claim for this book. There is a truth about it. One senses that from the beginning, as with very few writers.
You know, for me, what I wanted with this book was to achieve that sense of truth and that sense of a recognizable reality. When we talk about reality, you know, there's many types of reality. So when we read Kafka, it's not mimetic reality. It's not a physical reality that we can recognize, but it feels like reality. The same thing with the opening of The Brothers Karamazov, you know, with Father Karamazov going around telling people that his wife beats him. You know, that's recognizable. It's the same as, you know, the father going around and telling people that he's an alcoholic. It's recognizable that this sort of behavior occurs. You know, either we've already dealt with illness, right? Or we're going to deal with illness. There's nobody who is going to escape that. And because that illness is such a painful thing and is such an important thing, I want the book to be useful. I've been in hospitals. I've spent many, many years in hospitals. But I don't want to offer my advice to you unless you want the advice and unless you're ready for it. What I mostly want to do is recognize you for who you are and offer you help to the extent that I can offer help. My brother died 2 years ago and I was talking to my father and he was telling me that he felt abandoned by my brother's death. And I can relate to that. And you know, my advice, right, my instinct was to tell him, you know, that you have to focus on the future. You know, you can't keep looking back. And that there's almost, there's that decadence of looking at misery and wanting to love it and kiss it. And also because, you know, that misery is a way of holding on to the person you've lost. These were the thoughts that I had about how to move forward in a healthy way. And I said to him, you know, that it's, you did all you could. You know, you should feel proud. You know, it's awful what happened, but you should feel proud that you did everything you could, everything in your power. And that's sort of what I want, that sort of meeting him where he is what I want the book to do.
Akhil Sharma, you do it in this book. And let me just say, we're going to talk again and again and again, I hope, but it's a sheer joy to engage you like this. But I just want to bring this conversation to a close by affirming something that you're speaking about. Gorky said about Chekhov, to be with Chekhov was to want to be a better person, but also to live more in your own truth, to embrace it, to put it on, and then go forward, as you say. So this prose is, at some deep, granular level, I think, very instructive to all of us, morally. Live your truth. Live it today. Live it this moment. And, of course, I also have to wonder if how many of us you think have this kind of book, this kind of writing, this kind of truth-telling in us. Can you learn it over 12 years, writing a 200-page book?
You know, it's easier to tell the truth when you feel that the person you're telling it to loves you. We avoid the truth because we think it's painful. If we accept the truth as, and the bad truths, the shameful truths, as part of what it means to be a human being, and if we begin to realize that, you know, facing the truth and then trying to move on to who we want to be is a way of moving on towards happiness, then it becomes easier to tell the truth.
Thank you so much. I cannot thank you enough.
Thank you, Chris. It's really such a treat.
Akhil Sharma's new novel is Family Life. If conversations with poets and novelists are your taste, from Chekhov to Helen Oyeyemi, you'll find many more on our website at radioopensource.org. Please leave your own comments and suggestions while you're there. Mary McGrath is our open source producer. Kunal Jasti and Max Larkin are our indispensable fellow travelers, readers, and researchers. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.